And now for our weekly wrap-up of global politics with Dr. Stephen Hoadley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts. Good afternoon, Dr. Stephen. And we begin with the fallout from the US withdrawal from Afghanistan, which is ongoing. What's the latest update?
Good afternoon, Brian. Yes, as you can imagine, Americans are wondering what happened. And the Senate and the House of Representatives are each holding hearings in their Armed Services Committee, and they're calling the top generals to testify. Now, the top generals, General McKenzie, for example, General Milley, they've all agreed on one thing. It was the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan that precipitated the surrender of the Afghan military and the takeover by the Taliban. They do differ on who is to blame. The committees are staffed by Republicans who are opposed to the current government, Democrats who support the current government of Joe Biden. The Democrats indicate that it was the policy of Donald Trump, the preceding president, who promised to withdraw the troops. That was the cause of the withdrawal. The Republicans are blaming the current president, who carried on with the previous president's decision, and consequently, it's become a partisan issue. The American people, how do they feel about it? The majority say, good, we're glad we're out of Afghanistan. However, a majority also says that the Biden administration didn't conduct the withdrawal in an orderly and good fashion. So there's good and bad in public opinion. The question is, how will that reflect on the upcoming midterm elections next year? What will it hurt or help the Democrats to retain their slight majority in the Congress? Will it help or hurt the Democrats in the upcoming presidential election 2 years after that? Just a footnote, it also has implications downstream. The United States has some 80,000 Afghans that they have evacuated. On their way to the United States, they will have to be processed, being given temporary visas, then no doubt put on some sort of permanent visa arrangement. Likewise, New Zealand, some 408 New Zealand citizens and other visa holders have also arrived in New Zealand from Afghanistan, and they are in MIQ. They will have to be supported as they return to normal society. The debate here turns on whether the government should be doing more. And the previous Minister for Defense, Mark Mitchell, has said that he has a company, a private company, that specializes on extracting people from combat zones. There's a retired Army captain, Ellen Nelson. She claims that the government isn't doing enough. The government itself says, look, we are working on options. We have consulting with partners. We are removing people little by little. And that so the debate continues in this country that how to extract up to 1,000 additional people, bring them to New Zealand, and integrate them into society. So this is an issue, Brian, that we're going to be living with for some time to come. Let's hope it's a happy outcome for those who relocate here. I think we will welcome them. Many of them are talented, hardworking people, and if we can integrate them into the recovering economy, the post-COVID economy, then I think we'll all be the winners, Brian.
China's rapid rise has suffered from a few speed wobbles recently. Tell us more.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the fact that the Communist Party and the president, Mr. Xi, has clamped down on the billionaires, the platforms, the social media platforms like TikTok, Alibaba, and others, and even put some of the these entrepreneurs in jail. They want them to toe the party line. That is strict, austere measures. They don't like gaming. They don't like Western culture. They don't like things to do with sex or entertainment or lighthearted things. They want serious working Chinese working under the leadership of the Communist Party. And I said, well, Perhaps that's a good thing if the wealth is redistributed from the rich to the poor. I think we would mostly support that if it's done in a lawful and peaceful way, in an orderly way. But also, is this going to stunt the entrepreneur spirit in China, their ability to innovate, their leaders who think outside the square and bring new products, new processes online? Well, the latest is that the Chinese government has overbuilt the big construction company Evergrande, and some smaller construction companies as well, have now hundreds of empty offices, apartment buildings, and other infrastructural facilities. They've gone deeply into debt. According to one estimate, $300 billion in debt. It's a figure we can hardly comprehend, but in China, they do things in a big way. And this debt is owned by the large property developer, and the property sector in the Chinese economy is 15%. If we think that the property market is overheated here, it's also overheated in China. Now, what happens if this Evergrande company goes into receivership? It goes bankrupt. Remember what happened in 2008 when Lehman Brothers failed in the United States? It precipitated the global financial crisis. Is that a possibility now? Well, it turns out that the Chinese government is aware of the danger. It's instructed Bank of China and its subsidiary banks to ease up on the loan repayments, to, in some respects, buy some of the subsidiaries of this Evergrande company, and otherwise bring pressure to bear on the corporate sector, which is largely state-owned or controlled, to contain the damage. So it looks like the crisis is averted, but it does indicate something about the Chinese economy, that it is facing headwinds, that the spectacular growth of the Chinese economy cannot continue. The latest is on electricity. The price for coal and gas is going up. The Chinese government, to its credit, is taking climate change seriously and imposing emissions limits on some Chinese industries. And the combination of these factors mean that many of the Chinese coal-fired power stations are limited in the power, in the electricity output. There are outages, and this is causing a drop in production in the factories that require electricity. And consequently, this is just another headwind that the Chinese economy is facing. Now, I stress that you can still fly into a headwind, but you're not going to make progress as quickly or as efficiently as if you're flying with a tailwind. So keep an eye on this, Brian, because we're going to see if the Chinese economy can sustain the spectacular growth and the expansion of its military and other diplomacy around the world in the future as much as it has in the past, Brian.
And speaking of military, China has been threatening Taiwan. Cause for concern?
It's pretty scary stuff. If you live in Taiwan and you see something like an armada of 38 warplanes coming into your air control zone, this is pretty scary stuff. Now, they did turn around and go out. They didn't get into Taiwan's territorial waters. It was just in their economic zone and their warning zone. But still, it's an indication the Chinese are testing the defense capabilities of the government of Taiwan, the Republic of China on Taiwan. They're testing their radar light up. They're testing the ability of the interceptor aircraft to scramble and meet the challenge. They're learning a lot about the strengths and the weaknesses of Taiwan's defense. I don't think this foreshadows an immediate attempt to attack. I think that's down the track quite a little ways, depending on political situation. But it is a worry. The United States has called attention to that, indicated that it will sell increasingly defensive weapons to Taiwan, such as interceptor missiles, radar, and software. Will share satellite intelligence so that the Taiwanese will be well warned if the Chinese attempt any kind of mainstream attempt to attack. Nevertheless, it is a worry. It does indicate that the Chinese are ambitious. China wants to bring Taiwan under the Chinese flag again, the people in Taiwan say, no, we are not going to do that. We will fight. We want our independence, or at least our autonomy. And remember that Taiwan has been independent since 1911, when the Republic of China was proclaimed. So we'll keep an eye on this, and we'll see how this unfolds in the future, Brian.
Recent activity of the New Zealand Navy in the Middle East, Dr. Stephen.
This is a very interesting one. It doesn't involve a New Zealand Navy ship. In fact, the Navy officers are aboard a French ship. Now, remember, a few years ago, we had a lot of aggro with the French because of their nuclear testing. Well, now New Zealand and France work together very well in something called the Combined Maritime Forces, a maritime force of 34 nations, including New Zealand, that are cooperating in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Aden. And their job is to intercept terrorists, drug pushers, people smugglers, all kinds of crime and threatening activity. So the French have invited this New Zealand team, headed by Captain Brendan Clark of the Royal New Zealand Navy. And that team then takes charge of the strategic direction of the ship to intercept suspicious ships and to intercept their cargo. And the French captain, of course, will take orders, or at least take suggestions, from this task force, which is largely a New Zealand task force, which is in rotation. The 34 countries in rotation take turns commanding the task force. And blow me down, two great successes. Last week, they intercepted $2 million worth of drugs. And then a couple of days ago, they intercepted $2.5 million worth of drugs from an intercepted ship. So there are concrete results. And I think the New Zealand officers have proved their ability to take high-level command with a lot of help from the French, who, of course, supply the ship that actually carries out the action. But the New Zealanders, I think, deserve a lot of praise for reducing the drug traffic, which in turn supplies funding for many terrorist activities, Brian.
And finally, updates from the Pacific, Dr. Stephen.
Yeah, three bits of news. One, not so good, and two, good. So we've got a two-for-one on the happy side. And the not-so-good news is that United Nations Children's Fund, used to be called the International Children's Emergency Fund, has found a malnutrition in the Pacific region. And they single out several countries for critical analysis. They find that in the Pacific region, children are experiencing stunting, micronutrient deficiencies, and obesity. Stunting is reported to be very high in Solomon Islands and the Republic of Marshall Islands, where almost one-third of children are stunted, followed by Nauru and Vanuatu, with almost one-quarter of children stunted. Now, I don't have figures for Fiji, Samoa, and Tonga, others that are in the New Zealand sphere of influence, but we have to assume that some of these same problems might occur. And I'm sure that the authorities there, with assistance from New Zealand, Australia, and France, are trying to address these and to provide for better nutrition. Now, the good news. The good news is that there is a TV program, and very nicely reported in the Sunday Star Times, which focuses on good health. The World Health Organization that has pointed out that obesity and diabetes and heart disease are problems in the Pacific Islands, also points out that a program called the Pacific Island Food Revolution is very popular. And something like 85% of Tongans, 84% of Samoans, 63% of Fijians, and 49% of people of the Ni Vanuatu watch the program. And the program is run by a chef called Robert Oliver. I don't think any relation to Jamie Oliver. But he has been doing this for about 2 years. And what they do is they indicate what healthy food is like, how to prepare it, popularize the notion. And this has caused spinoff in Fiji. UNICEF partnered with a production in Fiji to create a YouTube series called Pacific Kids Food Revolution. In Samoa, HelloFresh and Women in Business have set up a program. Tongan, Princess Pilulevu also has a local cooking show that features healthy eating, in Vanuatu as well. So this is good news, and the New Zealand government certainly is behind this. The New Zealand government also helps to launch an event for Food Systems Summit, a United Nations initiative that features healthy eating. So there is help on the way, and many people are doing the right thing in the private sector, in the government, to increase the nutrition. And very finally and very briefly, Cuba. Cuba's a long ways away, but it turns out that Cuba has been a major benefactor to Pacific Island Health. Quietly, the Cubans have trained some 250 doctors from the Pacific region have gone to Cuba for training. Cuban doctors, some 50 Cuban doctors, have served in the Pacific Islands to increase the health delivery capacity there. And this program, although it's a little bit curtailed right now because of COVID, no doubt will continue in future if the Cuban government can economically sustain it, which I hope that they will do. So thanks very much to Cuba, a controversial country because it's still one of the few communist countries left, very much criticized by the United States. But we have to look at some of the good things that they're doing in the area of medical science, and this is one of them. So from the Pacific Islands, I think we should all be saying thank you, Cuba. Keep up the good work, Brian.
Dr. Stephen Hoadley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts for another week. Thank you so much for your time as always, Dr. Stephen, and we'll look forward to your company again same time next Wednesday. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you, Brian.